Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Hey friends, welcome back to the show. Today we've got some special for you from our friends at Zondervan. They are going to give away two autographed copies of one of the favorite books that I've read, my favorite books that I've read in the last year, which is Shauna Nequist's book, Present Over Perfect. So here's how you can win a copy of Shauna Nequist's book, Present Over Perfect, including her autograph. It's in there. They're going to autograph the book. Well, not they, just she. She's going to autograph them. What I need you to do is post on social media something about why you want a copy of Present Over Perfect. Maybe you want to give it to a friend. Father's Day, Mother's Day is just around the corner. Maybe you want to read it. Maybe you're a big fan of Shauna's. Whatever you want to do, post on social media and then make sure I see that. Maybe tag me in it or send it to me. And in the next 10 days, I'm going to pick out two winners, and we'll get your address and have the copies sent directly to you. So look for that. We're going to do the next 2 weeks. I think I'll put one more podcast out between now and then, which, side note, the next podcast, I think it's going to be a day or two late. We'll get the same amount out this month, but I think it's going to be about 2 days late. Surprise, the guest is someone I said is not going to be able to make it on the wrap-up, but they actually are, our friend from The Office, Dwight Schrute. Yeah, not the actor. The actor, not really Dwight. It's Rainn Wilson. But so this week, next week, while this podcast with David Dark and the podcast, which I think is going to air next week with Rainn Wilson, while those are out, post something about Shauna Nequist's book, Present Over Perfect, and I'm going to pick two. And by I mean my daughters. I'll just let them pick whichever one they like the best. Present Over Perfect, you want a copy? Do the thing. David Dark, here we go. All right, friends, welcome back to the show. Today we have joining us from Nashville, Tennessee, Dr. David Dark. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you?
Good. It's doctor, right? Like, you have a terminal degree of
something. It is. It's recent. I'm 47 years old. I taught high school for much of my adult life, and then I went back to school to get the doctorate. So I don't insist on it, but Dr. Dark is fun to say. It's like a Marvel comic villain, so why wait for the opportunity?
It really is a good, like, there is a Dr. Strange, and Dr. Dark sounds far more like ominous and sure. Impressive than Dr. Strange.
Yes.
Well, congratulations on the doctor.
Thank you.
Now, we've got a few connection points. Obviously, you've got ties in the Church of Christ.
Yes. Born and bred.
Are you still a part of a Church of Christ?
Well,
are you Presbyterian-y
this
now?
Probably a very Church of Christ answer, but I do view myself as a member of the movement, the Stone Campbell movement, and I don't think that I'm any less seriously devoted, to being an alternative witness in the world. Anabaptist, I sometimes like to say. Like to refer to myself as a high church Anabaptist with Buddhist leanings. So when I speak to Church of Christ folks and they try, and how they ever do, but if they were try to suggest that I'm anything other than a member at this point, I always want to say, well, I am a member.
You know what? I love that answer. I mean, some people would have just given a yes or no,
yeah.
But I really love the eloquence in which you gave that, which is a no. I mean, that sounds like a literal no, but a very poetic yes, and I'll take that.
Maybe that's what we have in this world, is the poetic yes. That's civilization itself.
You know, that's so true. I mean, that's all we've got.
Yeah.
Okay, so I saw you had a piece on Chance the Rapper on MTV.
Yes.
A year ago, 6 months ago, a little while back.
About a year ago.
And it was amazing. I saw. We'll get it. We've got questions for that.
Sure.
Like, don't think we're just going to skip right over that.
Okay.
It's all we got, you know?
Yep. That's all we've got.
Yep, this is all we got. It's not just music is all we got. We also have podcasts,
mm-hmm.
And podcasts is what we've got right now. You had a piece that came out on Mr. Rogers.
Yes.
Recently, it was really good. Somehow, your book, Life's Too Short to Pretend That You're Not Religious, came out and I didn't get a copy of it. I didn't have you on the podcast. I don't know whose fault that is, but someone's head needs to roll.
Let's blame the principalities and powers, and let's say that there's a conspiracy that is trying to to keep this conversation from happening because it's too much of a threat.
Yeah, because that book is clearly newsworthy. And
thank you.
I recently found out, Greg Daniel.
Oh yeah,
that's your agent. I recently signed with him, so we have like we're like cousins. I feel like we have some connection.
Yeah, brothers to another mother.
Exactly, not sisters to another mister, but just the brothers to another mother, and that's us. I absolutely I've really enjoyed Chance the Rapper's new album, and I'm not like a connoisseur of music. I don't feel like I can wade deeply into those waters, but I love it. And so I saw your piece on it, and I go, wait a minute. You're a 47-year-old white guy who's writing about hip-hop. What's going on here? There's some certain stereotypes that are not being lived into.
Well, I have a daughter who loves the good stuff. I like to think that I love the good stuff, too. Mm-hmm. As I like to say, you should check this out, is my love language. Yeah. And it happens that I have an editor friend who worked for Pitchfork for a while and then still works for MTV. Her name is Jessica Hopper. And she is kind enough, more than once, she has imagined with Kendrick Lamar or Chance the Rapper, for instance, that I might be able to weigh meaningfully on what they're up to, weigh in meaningfully. So I didn't know about Chance the Rapper because I'd seen him at Bonnaroo and my daughter was into him. But I did, my preparation for that piece was rather fresh. It's not the case that he was on my radar before I received that assignment. I'd like to pretend that he was, but I need to not front because there's no future in my fronting. But upon researching him, I am all in, and I am persuaded by everything that he's up to. It was a couple days of really digging into the lyrics, to everything that he's done, and trying to offer a meaningful word on what I take Coloring Book to be.
Okay, well, I think I quoted, he's got a line, don't trust in kings, trust in the kingdom.
Yeah.
Some line like that. And
don't believe in kings, believe in the
kingdom. Yes, there it is. Don't believe in kings, believe in the kingdom. And it might have gotten worked into a sermon not too long ago.
Wait.
And I don't know if I actually referenced him or not. I don't think he's going to be upset. Mm. But let me give you one of the highest compliments that I can give to a writer.
Okay.
I've read a couple pieces, and I downloaded your book on Friday, read a couple chapters of it.
Yeah.
You feel to me kind of like Chuck Klosterman.
Mm, yeah.
Do you know who that is?
I do.
He's one of my favorite authors, and you kind of have a Chuck Klosterman feel to you, and I mean that in the absolute highest compliment. Because you're integrating all this stuff together, which he does. He's a pop culture kind of connoisseur, and it seems like even in your Mr. Rogers piece, you're bringing Kendrick Lamar in, you reference how you're using that to your students, and as I seem to like synthesize some of your work down, like you're trying to remove this like faith, religion, culture division, and trying to like pull it all in together.
Yeah.
Is that like a strong impulse that you have?
Yes.
In your work? Yeah.
Yeah, and I it's the way, a line that I've had in more than one context. I like to say that the line between the secular and the sacred dissolves upon contact with the way my heart really works, what I really love, the idea that my reading of the Bible is in no way informed by my watching of the Twilight Zone or Black Mirror or something like that. It is all one thing in a lot of ways, and we don't need to keep our enthusiasms estranged from one another according to these boundaries or these genres. I think we do ourselves a disservice when we play that way.
Yeah, I think it was a Bard who said, "All truth is God's truth."
Sure.
And like, we're always trying to fold in our experiences into our understanding of the divine. Like, I don't think we can ever segregate that stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's talk let's talk about your Mr. Rogers piece. That was in, was it The Atlantic? Is that right?
No, it was America Magazine, which is a joke publication.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is that James Martin's thing?
Yes, it is.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. He's been on a couple times. So have you ever met him?
I haven't. We have some mutual people, and I love what he does and says, but we've never met.
Is your mutual person the Pope? Because I know he's
wouldn't that be
pretty amazing. Okay, so I would
delight in that. It's a guy named Nathan Schneider who I would encourage everybody to read up on.
I don't know Nathan. He sounds great though.
Yes.
Okay, so you wrote for Martin's thing. The America. What is it?
America Magazine.
America Magazine. Sorry, James. You start off and you kind of tell. As an earlier iteration of yourself, you
yes.
were deeply connected to Rush Limbaugh. And so he's, as I understood you in just a few sentences, that he was a guy who, when you were like 1920,
yep.
he was giving you like kind of an introduction to the world, and you took his worldview on as your own, and
sure.
you found yourself kind of like regurgitating his thoughts and his teaching, which is something that a lot of people in, I guess, both of our professions,
yeah.
preaching and teaching, can kind of digress into, where we just become like these caricatures that people just
yes.
mimic what we say.
It's
how
true.
How do you make sure that you don't end up in that same situation where people are just parroting your ideas?
Yes. Well, I would say that all eloquence is borrowed, that we are constantly doing that anyway. I think it was James Joyce who said, you never know whose thoughts you're chewing. We don't do a great job at acknowledging our sources or even recognizing our sources to ourselves. And I will say even now that Rush Limbaugh was probably the first person to really help me toward the insight that I own the White House, that senators and congresspeople and the president are my employees, and that the government we have is the government that we are ourselves voting and paying for.
Mm-hmm.
So Limbaugh was doing that from a particular angle, but I had not been able to figure that out through other people. But the problem in my dependence upon Limbaugh in the late 80s was Limbaugh could never be enough people. For me, he could never be, even if we were to credit him with a degree of wisdom, I needed a pantheon of elders. I needed other folks. And his personality was such that he was often seizing the microphone in my mind. But there were people who didn't love that I liked Limbaugh, who nevertheless credited me with more intelligence than just being what Limbaugh listeners refer to as ditto heads, is the way they put it at the mm-hmm. time, where they would call in and just say, I think what you think. And I think one way we can avoid doing that, or maybe one way I can avoid people doing that with me, is to encourage people to know that they have within themselves an intuition that they need to educate, and that one voice will never be sufficient in this process.
Yeah. It seems like the level of introspection that's required to do that.
Yeah.
Or maybe not just the level of introspection, but the willingness to invest the emotional energy and the time isn't something that we always want to do. Like, I've got certain people that, like, I've got a physical therapist guy that I read his stuff. Oh, yeah, I'm just going to take whatever he says to be true, because I don't have time to think through that. I've got an MBA guy who I listen to. Like, whatever he says about the MBA, I hold to be gospel.
Yes.
And I don't want to do the work to wrestle with the other voices.
Yes.
How do we encourage people to make the move you did to go, I need a pantheon, not just a singular voice?
Yes. Well, I like to think that even when we're being antisocial, or even when we're speaking in conversation stoppers to people, there is a cry for community. There is a deep desire for back and forth, mm-hmm. for somebody to throw the ball back at work within each of us. And I imagine part of it is trying to be someone. You know, sometimes we'll be in conversation and we'll say, you know what I mean? And we don't really want them to tell us if they know what we mean. They just want us to kind of nod so we can keep going. Thinking again of the being a person, I think monologue ends where dialogue begins. And if I have a tendency to shut people down or to not honestly seek their insight, I think I kind of fall into a kind of a vicious circle of self-legitimation where people aren't. People never dare to try to question what I'm saying. There has to be a way to kind of conduct ourselves more open-handedly than people who can't change their minds and won't change the subject.
So let's say hypothetically you did come to an actual Church of Christ church, specifically the one in Austin, Texas, where I'm the preacher. And
yes.
I do a monologue for 30 minutes every week.
Yes.
How do you imagine I would construct that monologue so that it wouldn't be me just trying to be the only voice? Instead, how can I like make it a Pantheon experience, even though I'm doing monologue, not dialogue?
Yes. Well, where you would show your sort, it kind of goes back to this thing of who we depend on, that you are quick to point people toward the your attention collection, the kind of quiver of thoughtfulness that you're drawing from as you're preparing your monologue, that we would be as transparent as we can be to tell people who we're reading, who we're getting our ideas from, and communicating to listeners that what we have to say really only comes alive when it becomes a back and forth. And when people have the opportunity to say how what we said struck them in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important for the community to know all of the ways in which it's kind of a mutual enrichment session rather than one person having the microphone the whole time.
Yeah. So I have this thing that I do every Thursday where I get five different people from our congregation to come up and have lunch with me. And so they eat their lunch and I do a rough draft of my sermon. And so I'll talk for do a shorter, like 20, 25 minute version of the sermon.
Yeah.
And then I say, like, what did you hear? And then almost every week I end up ripping something off from someone in our congregation who says it better than I could, who has an illustration. And here's a dirty little secret. When I do that, I kind of give like the structure, the main idea, but I'm always looking for like, where's the soul of the sermon? And I let that group give me the soul. And I will never tell them that, and I hope they don't hear this. And if you do, I'll lie to your face and say I don't. But truth be told, like that, for me, like that's one small way to make it dialogue. And I feel like in the community, you find the soul and the heart of like the good stuff, right?
Yeah.
So, okay, you have this line where you say calling someone a category. You know, liberal conservative is largely seen as a curse word to you.
Yeah.
Why? We like labels. It helps us process people. It helps me just put you in a box and say, this is who you are. What is so wrong about that, that you would use that as an expletive or treat it as one?
Yes. Well, we love our labels as ourselves. We are comforted by them. We believe that we've gotten to the bottom of someone else when we affix them with a label, to a great degree. I mean, they can be a convenience. We don't ever want to say so-and-so's only a liberal or only a conservative. But I would say that it is that costliest of mental shortcuts, because I believe that every human being is an infinitely valuable bearer of God's image, and that every human being is a process. To love a person is to love a process.
What do you mean process?
And if to love a person is to love a process, we are all becoming. Human being is a verb. I am not exactly the same person that I was last night. I am a shifting set of commitments and emotions and all of that.
Yeah.
And whenever I think that I have fixed someone with, we get fixated, we project, we reduce people to their use value. We often say, I guess this kind of gets to the dialogue thing again, in a conversation. I mean, hopefully it doesn't happen too often, but sometimes a person will say something, and then someone else will say, oh, so what you're saying is, and that, oh, so what you're saying is, if it's not, if it means I know what you meant, and any challenge you have to that is you lying, that's not really, again, it's the back and forth thing. And it is, I mean, when Jesus warns us against calling anybody a fool or an idiot or any reductive thing, I think that we are sort of partaking of the fire of accusation and destruction whenever we believe we've gotten to the bottom of someone else with a word. Mm-hmm. I think we're called to revere one another more, to, it's just basic neighbor love where I try to make sure that I'm not, that I'm rightly perceiving the person who I feel threatened by rather than just trying to shrink them down to size.
Yeah. If you just say that person's a fool, then whatever they have to say, you don't have to process, you don't have to listen to it.
That's right.
I like the idea that it's a we're changing, we're growing. Even in the conversation itself, hopefully we grow. One of my friends that I work with, Scott, his dad used to be a preacher. Now he went to the dark side and he's an elder. But before that, when he was a preacher, he had this great line. He used to say, if you quote me, date me. Which coincidentally was my strategy for getting a girlfriend when I was a single preacher.
Gotcha.
Same idea. But underline that notion is that if you're going to say what I said, you need to realize that I'm going to change over years. And are you a fan of Adele? Of course you are. Don't even
sure.
I know you're a fan. I label you a good person, which means you're a fan of Adele. But do you,
there you
like
go.
Her albums are her age? Like the last couple ones, I think she's going to stop that next. But I like that. I wish I could just say Luke Norsbury 35 whenever I say something.
Yes.
Because you know that when I'm 45, hopefully it's going to be a more refined and mature view of whatever I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. This is the hope. The hope is that when I'm 60, I will look back on my 47-year-old self and know that I had quite a ways to go, that I can view my earlier self with compassion. Process always.
You had a reference to Maya Angelou in your book about the word Christian is.
Yeah.
Like I'm a practicing Christian. It's just something about she doesn't like the label other than it's like I'm working on becoming a Christian.
Yes, when people say identify themselves as Christian, she wants to say playfully already.
Oh, that's
I've been trying so hard. And I think that's good because it is an aspiration. If it's ever a boast or a mission accomplished, I mean, there was a politician not too long ago who was in a campaign ad, was walking through the woods, and he said, I'm proud to call myself a Christian. And of course, I thought, and this is my Church of Christ thing too, you shouldn't be. You should not presume that you are a finished product. At best, we are aspiring followers of Jesus. But to think of it as a kind of something that we could have over somebody else, I think is to misunderstand the movement to which Jesus calls people.
Yeah, you had the line about anytime someone says, as a Christian, whatever they say next isn't good. I've heard a comedian make a similar thing about whenever someone starts a sentence with, as a taxpayer, you're always going to be a jerk after you say those things.
It's true.
Because those seem to be labels that we put on ourselves, which we're moving ourselves into the expert or the wise sage because of this term that I give myself. Yeah.
It's true, and it's right in there with Jesus' teaching against calling people fools. When he says, let your yes be yes and your no be no, he says that anything extra is from the evil one. And I do think that so often in the way we introduce our statements, we try to be something other than human beings among human beings and try to add a little bit of authority to it. And I don't think we're serving ourselves or others well when we fall into that. Yeah.
So we don't want to say I'm a Christian because that gives me in an attempt to grab power, like as an authority claim.
Yeah.
But I do think you would say is that even if identifying myself as a Christian might not be ideal, we all to some degree are religious because you have a much bigger view of what religion is than what many of us would boil it down to. Would you just give a brief intro to how you define that?
Well, I'm not, I should qualify it by saying that I'm not trying to get anyone to start calling themselves religious. I would just say that we're involved in an alarmingly uncool move when we speak of religion as some kind of water that others are swimming in that we have evolved past. Yep. I would just say religion is your controlling story. It is however you are bound. It's your bonds. It's what shapes you. And it never stops. I kind of do the same thing with worship. I would say there is no on or off switch to worship. And if someone were to say, I'm not a religious person, I might say, well, would you be up for being challenged on that? And if they said yes, I would say, well, show me your receipts, a transcript of everything you've done and said in one day, your gas mileage, your internet history, all that kind of thing. And we will begin to get a sense of what your religion is, what your witness is, because your witness is the sum of everything that you're up to.
Okay, we're going to get to worship services in a second.
Okay.
Define that again. Your witness is the sum of what?
Your witness is the shape your loves and hates take. Your witness is the sum of all that you do and say.
Okay, so I've been processing this idea, and the internet history, the words you say.
Yeah.
If you were to go back and look at the internet history on my phone, there is a great deal of investment in the NFL draft.
Sure.
And
if that liturgy, it's liturgy after all.
Okay, so I want you to break down my religion of NFL, because it is my go-to, like, I want to relax. I want to just talk about football and turn my mind off. How is that my religion if I'm fascinated about who the Cowboys are going to take? This will actually be posted after the draft, so some people will...
Yeah, we have more than one, but culture is made up of traditions. Wherever there's a culture, there's always a cult, many cults.
Yeah.
No cult without a culture. So if I was to say that you are invested in the NFL cult, I'm not. I'm just being descriptive. There's no value judgment in that.
Yeah,
any more than saying I'm invested in the Star Trek tradition or Doctor Who or Radiohead or something like that. And we're all made up of many traditions, and we're all religious hybrids in a way. The stories, the concerns, the hopes, the enthusiasms that make up the devotion of our energies, that is our very mixed religious bag.
Okay. You said, I think you said this in your book somewhere, that traditions are simply like what is passed down. Is there something from like the Latin?
Yeah.
Like, what is that?
It's tradere, is trade, is hand over. Mm-hmm. And we are, I know that I'm a beneficiary of the biblical tradition. I hope that I'm a faithful practitioner of the biblical tradition. There's the Star Wars tradition. There's the Harry Potter tradition, and it's kind of a throw a rock and you'll hit a tradition. They're all around us.
I think we can all get that we invest in these stories, whether the story is music, fantasy, like they're all to some degree like these things that we've invested our life into. We've poured ourselves, we've given part of our soul over to them. Mm-hmm. But how do I understand that as a religion? I get that it's a large part of my life that I've invested myself into, but how is it like shaping me? Besides just a general knowledge of this is what happens next. These are the characters. This is the storyline. This is the adversity to over. Like I know that stuff, but how is it? Because I think of a religion like the Latin word to rebind. Like it's shaping me in terms of my character, my direction.
Yes. Well, it's what forms us.
So just diagnose me. I'm opening you up. Like I'm giving you a blank slate. Come on, diagnose me.
I will note of myself, I mean, one goofy little story with which I open the book is my own anxiety over, would it be okay to tell this story, the crackers and grape juice story?
Oh, yeah. Go for it. Yeah,
okay,
I like it.
So I'm 18. I'm working in a movie theater on a Sunday, which I felt guilty about. it's the 80s, Princess Bride, Top Gun, all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I realize as we midnight that my I'm missing communion. I'm missing the Lord's Supper for the first time since I was baptized. So I don't want to tell anybody about that, but I do want to get this taken care of. So I asked somebody to kind of mind the concession stand, and I rushed down to the nearest Kroger. Maybe it would be HEB for Texas listeners.
Yeah, you got it.
I run up and down the aisles looking for crackers and grape juice, and I get them, and I stumble out into the parking lot, rip open the saltines, try to be in the right frame of mind as I take the crackers and take mm-hmm. the grape juice, and then I look at my watch, and I had 2 minutes to go. I made it. Yeah. I got it down before midnight. And I laugh to myself. I mean, I was serious, but I laugh a little bit too. And why do I laugh? Because I get to wondering what Steve Martin would think of this. And I wonder about The Twilight Zone. I think about Doctor Who. I think about this sort of great cloud of pop culture witnesses who would have an interesting angle on my angst. So when I do, there's a way of telling that story that is, I was a religious nut and I got saved by all of these pop culture secular influences. But I would say instead that it was this great cloud of pop culture witnesses who had formed me and continue to form me in ways not unlike my Sunday school curriculum, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, my desire to be along the trajectory of the saints or those who have gone before. Mm-hmm. And a little formula I have for that is that we're stuck with our relatives, but we get to choose our ancestors.
That's good.
And so my ancestors aren't just those who are easily named as Christians or mystics or spiritual people. They include those who haven't made it into that category, but who are every bit as much a part of my formation mm-hmm. As the others.
Yeah, that's good. You have another quote about people who can't make the world into a story go mad.
Yes.
And it seems like we're always trying to find stories to make sense of the world. What is yeah. the, there's a title of a book that came out, Storytelling Monster or something. Like that, we're always craving stories because they make
yeah,
sense
of the
world.
Yeah, and I think when we go to the end, when we tune into the World Series, when we watch Breaking Bad, when we dip into the news cycle to see the last thing that the president said, we are hunting for a story, for lines of continuity, mm-hmm. and for good news that'll make us feel like maybe things aren't falling apart.
Yeah. So in worship services, you would say that we can schedule them as much as we'd like,
yep.
but they're not going to stop or start according to the times yep. posted on our door. Like, we're always having these worship things that are giving us meaning, shaping our identity.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
never not worshiping.
So in light of the cornucopia of religious experiences that we have in our day-to-day life, almost a incessant cacophony of worship opportunities.
Calls to worship, yeah.
Yeah. What then is the place for the 10 o'clock church hour? How do people like me separate yeah. the voice of our Christian tradition from all the other traditions that are competing for
yes.
for our heart?
Yes, well, the hope would be that the other traditions that we don't think of as Christian traditions are enriching traditions, are life-giving traditions that we invest in with our money, with our time, with our fandom even, where we lift up Chance the Rapper or Kendrick Lamar, whoever. We share them in our intelligence gathering. But the service, I am Church of Christ enough that even though we're at a Presbyterian church now, when we go in, my kids know to say, not that we're going to church, but that we're going to church building. Mm-hmm. We're going to the meeting of the community whereby we restore our wits and discern what we're up to and review our week. to figure out the ways in which we are aligned or not quite rightly aligned with seeking first God's kingdom and righteousness in all that we do. So I would view that service, which is usually Sunday mornings, as a kind of meeting for communal discernment, for figuring out what we need to be about so that we can enjoy our lives more and so that we can witness to something greater than our, just seeking after an income.
Yeah, that's good. And I think this brings up the point of you've got other voices that are trying to get into your heart just as much as the voice that, you know, you're trying to hear from your sacred texts or in the sacraments or whatever traditionally classified as religious practice you're doing.
Yeah.
And you talk about art in your book, and you say that the voice, the tale, the image, the parable that gets through to you that wins your heart religiously is the one that makes it past your defenses.
Yeah.
And so it seems like there is a calling for the preacher or for the musicians to be artists who are able to get through because they have to compete against all these other voices that are trying to have supremacy in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And so is this a calling for pastors and preachers for us to be better artists, you think?
I think the call to artfulness is for everyone, that we are called to be more artful, to think more beautifully and poetically and therefore realistically in our consideration of one another, the issues, the neighborhood, the life around us. I like to say that art is a feat of attentiveness, and we are all called to deep attentiveness to everything that we're up to. And that's definitely the call of the poets, the pastors, the prophets.
Let's go back to that line you just said. Art is the attentiveness. How'd you say?
A feat of attentiveness, F-E-A-T.
Yeah. I would almost channel my inner Richard Rohr and say that to see as a mystic is not to hope that God answers your request for God to show up, but instead for you to live in such a disposition that you're always aware of God's presence.
Yeah.
And so so what I think Ian Cronin would talk about, the Catholic imagination, is to like view this world as already imbued with the presence of God. And so it's so it's almost like that is the same sort of artistic disposition that you would have of like you're always being attentive to the voices that are around you that actually are the truth and love in the midst of them, or that have that.
Yes, and that is the way to think through pop culture, novels, films, Netflix series. I will note that years ago when I wrote a book that celebrated The Simpsons, there were those who wanted to say, oh, I get it. You're using The Simpsons to tell people about Jesus. I like that. And I was always tempted to play along with it, but I had to say, if I was going to be honest, no, I'm not using The Simpsons or Beck or Flannery O'Connor or Coen Brother films. I just love them. Yeah. I think they're good, and I'm trying to bear witness to their already righteous witness. Yeah. I'm not trying to squeeze a spiritual component out of it. I don't know what that would look like. I'm not trying to, I guess I am trying to pull them into a conversation, but their art, beauty is its own. The poet Daniel Berrigan says the rose is its own credential. And so when something is true or beautiful or honest, that's already gospel. It's already good news. It's not waiting for me to, fit a grid over it or something like that.
I went to a church service once, and the church was having taking God at the movies kind of sermon series.
Yeah,
and I like to connect stories, gospel, kind of see what the connection is. And so I was interested to see what they were doing. And Iron Man had just came out, and I think the move was like, you know, Jesus is the Iron Man for all of us. Saves it. And it's just man, you didn't even engage. No. All you did is take the title of the movie and show the trailer and then just perverted it. Like
it is a perversion.
And the same way that like bad Christian art is defamation of the good news.
Yeah.
To not engage, it's almost like you don't even listen.
It's true.
And that's disheartening.
Now, whenever someone says, I liked the message of that film or that album, I'm really uncomfortable with ever saying that any of these things have a message. Exactly. I do prefer the word witness.
Why don't you want to say they have a message?
Because you're reducing the song, the film, the story to something that could be said in a sentence. Elvis Costello was once asked, you know, what does this song mean? And he said, well, all I can do is play it back for you. If I could have said it in a sentence, I would.
Yeah.
Or if a film is over and then the director comes out during the credits and says, what this film was about, you know, that strikes me as it was probably propaganda if you could reduce it to a sentence or two.
So the temptation for preachers when you tell a story is to turn everyone into a parable that has a nice, neat, digestible point at the end. And to some degree, you know, Jesus tells parables.
I mean,
the Good Samaritan is a parable that has a meaning, and the parable of the sower is a story that has a specific meaning.
It's true.
And so I would
say that a parable never stops saying what it has to say. To suggest that any parable or any analogy or metaphor that you can kind of say, here's what it means, and then you're done, is to render it something other than the living word of God. We often say in sermons, what Jesus is really trying to say here, and we end up really messing with the mystery, with the witness of what's going on. I think of N.T. Wright saying that to receive a parable is to enter into a new world that didn't exist until you heard the parable. So that would be part of my resistance with the word message, or to ever suggest. I know when we read the Bible out loud at my church, we'll often say, listen for the word of the Lord, trying to suggest that though we're going to try and expound on what we take to be the word of the Lord this time in our reading of this scripture, that we would never want to do a kind of, and now we have the definitive interpretation of the parable of the unmerciful servant.
Yeah.
I mean, we want to let it keep going.
Yeah, you have a line about to presume to have arrived at the right reading to which anyone else who comes to it will have to submit is to go completely bonkers and miss the boat entirely. And that's how I used to read, is like, this is the right reading of the text. And you use historical critical method, and you get through all the context and the language and the linguistic stuff and the genre, and then you get the right reading. And I used to read that way, and now I've moved to not the right reading, but a good reading. And I feel like there's so much life. There's so much, like you're saying, listen for the word of the Lord.
Yeah.
Like you can hear God in it when you don't reduce it down to just, hey, this is something like a mathematical equation that I can eventually solve and tell you the word reading.
Yes, a timely reading, a good interpretation for a particular situation, but it's always going to mean more than whatever we think we nailed down the last time we read it.
Yeah. I've got this thing where I've stopped highlighting in my Bible because I don't want to reduce it to one reading of the text. And if I highlight and I make a note in it, every time I read it after that, it's going to be the same one. And I don't want that. I want a fresh reading.
Yeah. That's it.
Okay. I feel like we've covered a lot here. I feel like we've, we fixed a lot of things in the world, to be honest.
Mission accomplished.
Tell me what album you're listening to right now.
Ooh, okay. Well, I'm always listening to Radiohead.
Okay.
Moon-Shaped Pool, their latest. And sometimes when people say, you know, what's the best Radiohead album, I always want to say, well, the latest. I believe that everyone is an evolution. And so their song Daydreaming kind of feels like the best song ever written to me at the moment. I'm listening to the new Kendrick Lamar and loving that a lot.
Okay.
And a whole bunch of Joni Mitchell, who I feel like I've been deaf to for much of my life. I'm kind of receiving her witness truly for the first time.
It's good. What's the most recent show that you've been watching?
Let's see here. I'm watching Luke Cage.
That's a good one.
And I'm starting one called The OA on Netflix, which has been interesting. And I'm excited about the new season of Stranger Things, which was a real ministry of weirdness to me. The first season.
Yeah.
And I want more.
Wait, three doesn't come out until the fall, right?
Correct. Yeah. So we've only had one Stranger Things season, and we've got a new one coming in the fall.
Okay. That's all good. Luke Cage is great. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen the OA. Have you watched, we're just going to go talk about TV shows now. Have you watched Crashing on HBO?
Crash.
You know, Pete Holmes is a comedian, grew up conservative.
Yes.
Evangelical in Boston.
Yes.
Became a comedian.
Okay.
After his wife. Anyway.
Yeah.
You haven't watched
it? I have not. I've heard that he's a great interviewer. Like, he had Barack Obama on and lots of great people, I think.
Yeah. He's actually been on this podcast.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And he actually took over the conversation very quickly.
Oh, wow.
And so he definitely is, he's a good interviewer.
Okay.
I mean, even if he's being interviewed, I mean, he still will be the interviewer. Yeah. He's very talented like that. Interesting story about like the digression of conservative evangelical to kind of new agey kind of guy.
Yes.
But okay. All right. Well, you need to watch that. I feel like what we need to do next time is we need to get a list of things that we both watched and then discuss them.
Okay.
I feel like you'll be outstanding with that.
Oh, I will welcome that situation.
Okay. Well, I think we're friends now, and we've got something to build on here. The book that the most recent book, which to take your same interpretive tool for Radiohead, is your most outstanding book. It's the best evolution of you. Life's Too Short to Pretend You're Not Religious.
Yes, this is the one.
It's been out for a while. I'm sorry I didn't have it. Like, get you on right away.
It's totally okay. It's a slow burn. I believe it'll have a long life.
Who published that?
InterVarsity Press.
Okay, well, that's IVP, whatever.
Yes,
it's their fault for not getting it.
Oh, rough.
And, we'll put them on the hate list.
There you
okay.
Go.
Hey, thanks for the time, David.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.